Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one on your phone to ask a question. I would like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Benjamin Haynes. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Courtney, and thank you all for joining us for today's CDC Vital Signs briefing. We are joined by Dr. Deborah Howry, Acting CDC Principal Deputy Director, and Dr. Bobazi Karisa from the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control. Both will provide brief opening remarks before taking your questions. As a reminder, this briefing is embargoed until 1 p.m. when our Vital Signs report is live on the CDC website. I'll now turn the call over to Dr. Howry.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. As CDC continues to address infectious disease risks like COVID-19 and monkeypox, we are also working 24/7 to address other public health issues that impact the well-being of all Americans every day. CDC's Vital Signs reports spotlight many of these serious health threats and the proven actions that can be taken to curb these threats. Many people may already be aware that the rate of drug overdose deaths grew about 30% from 2019 to 2020 and continues at a historically high level. In just the 1 year, overdose death rates increased 44% for black people and 39% for American Indian and Alaska Native people. Today we focus on a critical part of curbing this disturbing trend, namely these disparities in drug overdose deaths. During this telebriefing, you'll hear more about these trends that highlight significant disparities and how they have worsened, particularly overdose death rates for black and American Indian and Alaska Native people. We will also discuss what can be done about these deaths. Early in my career as a physician at Grady Memorial Hospital right here in Atlanta, I saw firsthand how overdose impacted lives, families, and communities. And at that time, options for patients for treatment were limited. After joining CDC, I have continued to volunteer at a substance use disorder clinic for people with opioid use disorder. And I have seen the profound effect substance use disorders can have on a person's life. I have also seen the tremendous impact treatment with medications can have on opioid use disorder. Recovery coaches and peer-based recovery support services are another key piece and a person's recovery journey. While we have made so much progress in treating substance use disorders as chronic conditions rather than moral failings, there is still so much more work to do, including making sure that all people who need these services can get them. Racism, a root cause of health disparities, continues to be a serious public health threat that directly affects the well-being of millions of Americans and, as a result, affects the health of our entire nation. The disproportionate increase in overdose death rates among blacks and American Indian Alaska Native people may partly be due to health inequities like unequal access to substance use treatment and treatment biases. When policies, programs, and systems that support health are equitable, poor health outcomes can be reduced, health disparities can be prevented, and all of society benefits. At CDC, we are committed to addressing the challenges driven by structural factors. Racism, discrimination, and historical disenfranchisement that deeply impact the communities we live in. As an agency, we recognize the systemic nature of the inequities that exist across our nation. In our communities where people live, learn, work, and play, and in our healthcare infrastructure. We are working to address the many roadblocks that prevent equal access to care for all. To advance health equity and to sustainably address disparities in drug overdose prevention and care, we believe that now is the time to provide communities with the additional resources they need. I want to thank all of those at CDC who have worked tirelessly to prepare this much-needed Vital Signs, and to all of those who are on the ground who work hard every day to bring resources to communities across the country. Now I'll turn it over to Dr. Carissa to share findings from the report.
Thank you, Dr. Oury. As Dr. Oury mentioned, drug overdose deaths increased by approximately 30% from 2019 to 2020. We know that health disparities play a key role in overdose death rates among people from certain racial and ethnic minority groups. In just 1 year, overdose death rates increased 44% for Black people and 39% for American Indian and Alaska Native people. Overdose death rates also varied by racial and ethnic age groups. Younger Black people, 15 to 24 years old, saw the largest increase in overdose death rates, 86% between 2019 and 2020, compared with other racial and ethnic groups. In American Indian and Alaska Native people, the largest increase of 49% occurred among young people 25 to 44 years old. Also notable, overdose death rates in Black men over 65 years old were nearly 7 times as high as those in older white men. And in women, overdose death rates were nearly 2 times higher for younger American Indian and Alaska Native women, 25 to 44 years old, than for younger white women. A history of substance use was commonly reported, with the highest percentage among white people at 78%, American Indian and Alaska Native people at 77%, and Hispanic people at 75%. However, there was a substantially lower percentage of people from racial and ethnic minority groups showing evidence of ever receiving treatment for substance use compared to white people. The percentage with evidence of prior treatment for substance use was lowest for Black people at 1 in 12. Among American Indian and Alaska Native people and Hispanic people, only about 1 in 10 received prior substance use treatment. In fact, most people who died by overdose had no evidence of getting substance use treatment before their death. Some conditions in the places where people live, work, and play can widen these disparities. These findings show that people from certain racial and ethnic minority groups have higher drug overdose death rates and less access to treatments for substance use disorders that are known to work. This difference is not simply because of a lack of availability of services. In communities that have a higher capacity to provide care, overdose deaths were higher, particularly for Black and American Indian and Alaska Native people. Another factor is income inequality. For instance, areas with a wider income gap between the rich and the poor have higher death rates of overdose death. And among Black people, overdose rates in counties with the most income inequality were more than twice those of counties that had less income inequality. Income inequalities often negatively impact people from racial and ethnic minority groups at higher levels. This can lead to lack of stable housing, reliable transportation, and health insurance, making it even more difficult for people to access treatment and other support services. The results in this report show how important prevention strategies are to reducing the risk for overdose and health-related disparities. Now turn it back over to Dr. Oury, who will describe some of the potential solutions to reduce high rates of drug overdose death.
Thank you, Dr. Carissa. Drug overdoses are preventable, yet continue to reap excess harm on the health and well-being of certain groups, including Black, American Indian, and Alaska Native people. So what can be done? To end drug overdose death disparities, we will need to address the systemic factors, such as lack of awareness of just how lethal the illicit drug supply is, and to address the limited, or in some cases, lack of access to treatment, recovery services, and harm reduction actions known to work. The goal is to prevent health differences from evolving into public health injustice. The drug landscape is evolving. The use of illicit drugs and increased prevalence of polysubstance use or using more than one drug are causes for serious concern. Fentanyl, a highly potent opioid, has been a major driver of overdose deaths in recent years. The increasing spread of illicitly made fentanyl in the drug supply is a major concern associated with the risk of overdose, including for people using other drugs like cocaine or methamphetamine who may not know they are being exposed to these potent and deadly opioids. It is critical for prevention efforts to address fentanyl and polysubstance use and work to reduce historical health inequities. We need to promote primary prevention, such as preventing childhood traumas, as well as preventing youth from using substances in the first place, and to also raise awareness about how lethal the illicit drug supply is, and expanding access to treatment, recovery support services, and harm reduction actions known to work. We need to increase access to treatment for all people who have substance use disorders. This is such a critical part of care and recovery. Harm reduction services can save lives. These include using naloxone to reverse overdoses, using fentanyl test strips to tell whether drugs have been mixed or cut with fentanyl, and getting people into substance use disorder treatment. Syringe service programs can reach people who use drugs to provide them with overdose prevention education and opportunities to link to substance use disorder treatment and other risk reduction actions. Some prevention strategies will have more immediate benefits, while others will have longer-term and sustained effects. It's clear that community-based prevention and response efforts can incorporate culturally responsive actions to address disparities in drug overdose deaths and the inequities that contribute to them. To advance health equity, public health professionals, healthcare providers, policymakers, and communities can consider several solutions. First, improve access to and the reach of treatment and recovery support services through telehealth and similar options, and expanding insurance coverage can help. Two, offer structural support such as housing assistance, transportation assistance, and childcare to improve people's ability to access care. There are many actions to consider for all those involved in the work of fighting overdoses. Next, when suitable, combine culturally appropriate traditional practices, spirituality, and religion with evidence-based substance use disorder treatment. Also, help raise awareness and reduce stigma around treatment and recovery with culturally tailored prevention programs and campaigns. Support efforts that focus on the health of the individual over criminal punishment or penalties and destigmatize drug use so individuals with substance use disorders feel safer seeking help without fear of incarceration. And lastly, link people to treatment from a variety of settings. These may be primary care, syringe services, or other harm reduction programs, as well as healthcare settings during incarceration. Public health departments can bring together criminal justice, healthcare, social services, employers, and government partners. And using trusted messengers can help people to continue treatment over time. Everyone can play a role in preventing overdoses. One way to do that is by reading and sharing resources about overdose prevention and raising awareness about the communities that are disproportionately impacted by overdose. Learn how to recognize the signs of overdose and carry life-saving naloxone with you and keep it at home. I keep it in my bag, just like I carry a first aid kit to protect family, friends, or anyone in the community from an overdose. We as individuals can also learn more about reducing stigma, which can be a major barrier for those seeking help. While we put these actions to work, we must also tend to the long-standing inequities and root drivers of substance use and overdose disparities. One of the ways we can address this is through primary prevention efforts by preventing or mitigating the effects of adverse childhood experiences that can increase the risk for substance use and use disorder and are also a root cause of health disparities. comprehensive efforts that address systemic inequities have the greatest potential to prevent overdose. We are ready to take some questions now.
Thank you, Courtney. We're ready to open up the lines.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name and affiliation clearly. If you need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Our first question comes from Andrew Joseph from STAT. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. You may be aware of this, but there was a JAMA Psychiatry paper, I think, published in March that basically calculated the increase in overdose deaths by race and ethnicity through 2020, and it found pretty similar things to what you all found. But I guess what I wanted to ask about is that there's this frustration from outside researchers about how long it takes for overdose data to be reported, particularly by drug type, and how long it takes for CDC to do these analyses. So what are some of the barriers to speeding that up, and what is the agency doing to help with that? Thank you.
Great question. You know, CDC has really been acting to have more timely data available to the public. One of the ways we've done this is through the provisional data that is now available on our website. We have cut this down to about a 4 to 5 month data delay for fatal overdoses. For some of our other conditions, this comes out much more quickly, but for fatal overdoses, it does require coroners and medical examiners as well as the drug toxicology reports to come back. That's why we've been looking at some of our other systems, like the SUDOR's data system that we reference in our vital signs report. That allows us to also get reports from coroners and medical examiners, such as information about scenes, to really add to the richness of this data. We're also looking at things like our syndromic surveillance, where we look at ED visits for non-fatal overdoses, and some of our states are reporting that in less than a month, and we now have this on our website with a data dashboard to where you can see this really timely data. So we're really working to address timely data, funding to continue to support coroners and medical examiners, to provide states the resources that they need to have updated vital statistics is really important. And this is also part of our larger data modernization efforts at CDC to improve data quality and timeliness across all of our topics.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Emma Court from Bloomberg News.
Hi. Thanks for the briefing today. I was wondering if you could speak about the impact of the pandemic on some of the trends you've discussed, especially how the pandemic may have, played a role in, perhaps disrupting some of the solutions you've discussed, such as treatment, structural support, factors like that. Thanks.
So I think it's really important to recognize that pre-pandemic, drug overdoses were already a significant issue and were going up prior to the pandemic. And as you ask, during the pandemic, there were disruptions to access to prevention services. There were disruptions to treatment initially, and certainly harm reduction services also. People couldn't access these services. There's other things to consider, too, like social isolation. So drug users might be using alone and not near a bystander or someone that has naloxone. So this also contributed to it. And then we know that things like economic instability, stressors, things like that can also lead to increased drug use. And then finally, during the pandemic, we did see disruptions and changes in the illicit drug supply. So all of these likely contributed to the increased overdose deaths.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Ariel Dreyer from Axis.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my question. I'm curious why half the states are not reporting their overdose data through SUDOR's, and then what the CDC can do to change some of the harm reduction strategies that aren't happening in some states, like having fentanyl test strips legalized. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that question. So for SUDOR's, we actually fund 47 states and the District of Columbia to participate in SUDOR's. For this analysis, we restricted it to 26 jurisdictions that had complete data for both 2019 and 2020. So although that's not representative of the entire United States, it does represent a variety of states in different regions across the country, with different demographics and population characteristics. And I can turn it over to Dr. Auri to answer your second part of the question.
So with fentanyl test strips, you know, we've worked closely with our other government agencies over the past year, and with the federal funding, we're not able to provide funding to our state health departments to use fentanyl test strips in a variety of different means. We have seen them pairing, like in Florida, looking at patient navigators who are out in the field focusing on homeless patients for ways to distribute fentanyl test strips. And then in Atlanta, there was a great example of where they were meeting people where they were at, and through some of the harm reduction sites, they did COVID vaccinations, HIV screening, and provided fentanyl test strips. So I think it's really looking at ways that you can do this through the programs, through the health departments, and at CDC, we are working actively with any states that do have issues with this distribution, but we're seeing a lot more work through our harm reduction partners and continue to make progress in this area.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Tara Long from Time.
Hello. Thank you for answering my question. I wanted to ask how you feel money from the opioid settlement funds should be spent most effectively to reduce drug overdose deaths.
So I think, you know, just focusing on what we can do overall for overdose prevention, you know, whether it's settlement funds, communities, educators, focusing first on primary prevention, so upstream things we can do, such as making sure kids in school have the tools they need to build resiliency, to handle conflict, and to be aware of the use of drugs. I think making sure there's good access to treatment for those who need treatment, and expanding that to more than just opioids, as we know that there's polysubstance use, and we need to broaden the treatment options. Making sure naloxone, so that we can save a life, is distributed more throughout. And then certainly I'm looking at, again, risk reduction and harm reduction through things like fentanyl test strips. So I really think it's looking at, you know, primary prevention, linking to treatment, as well as being able to reverse an overdose, and then supporting recovery services so that somebody who is on the path to recovery also has the job supports that they need, the educational resources they need, so they can lead a successful and productive life. And I guess the last thing I would say is maybe supporting public messaging, because we do need people to be aware of resources that are out there and to decrease the stigma. We want people to come forward when they need help. We want people to realize that there are treatment opportunities, and we want people to have hope.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Lucy Oberg from ASP.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. What is your take on supervised consumption sites, like the one which opened last year in New York, as a way to help fight inequalities? Could this kind of center be part of the answer in certain communities where disparities are the highest? Thank you.
So we've been working across the federal government to always look at innovative practices and new solutions. I know that some of these sites have been internationally in place for quite some time, but the data, we haven't seen it in the U.S. So at this point, we don't have an opinion on it because we haven't seen the data from these sites in the U.S. Once there's good evaluation studies from this site in New York City, we'll be better poised to give more guidance on this.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Sophia Gratis from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I know that we didn't get like every state in this analysis. I'm curious if you saw any patterns regionally. I'm specifically interested in the South. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. For the analysis specifically, we combined data from all 25 states and the District of Columbia. We didn't break it down by region or by urbanicity, for example, but we did look at it by a number of different sociodemographic factors. But our analysis was restricted specifically just to the combination of 25 states and the District of Columbia.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Annette Newell from Alpha Media.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to find out from you. Here in Oregon, we've seen that fentanyl is driving the deadly overdose trend. Fentanyl deaths increased 600% between 2019 and 2021. And we've found that it's really hitting teenagers hard. So I don't know if your research looked into the age group that's most effective. Is that something that's happening across the country? And also, any advice for parents out there of teenagers?
Yes. In our analysis, we are actually able to look at different breakdowns, so not just race, ethnicity, but also sex and age groups. And we found that the highest increase between 2019 was actually between 2019 and 2020 was actually between younger black males aged 15 to 24. So there was an increase of 86% in their drug overdose death rates. By comparison, among Hispanic males in the same age group, it was about 47%. And among white males, it was 34%. So we did look at that breakdown, and we did see quite staggering differences when it came to certain age groups and certain race ethnicities being impacted by drug overdose increases. And I can turn it over to Dr. Auri to answer your second question.
So with fentanyl, you know, we are certainly worried about this with all populations and with youth in particular, that a single use can kill. So somebody that may not be used to using drugs or use them often, you know, we've seen the reports of people at a party who do a single pill that's mixed with fentanyl and die. And that's why it's so important that we have these programs in schools and talk about, you know, how to handle stress and conflict management so that they don't use drugs. But we also have developed public service announcements around fentanyl, really pointing out the deadliness of this drug. It's available on our website and certainly can be shared with schools and other parents. And then I think the third thing I would just say as a parent of a teenager is to have those conversations at home. To really talk about the dangers of fentanyl, have your kids come to you. And also, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, I carry naloxone with me. I think this is something parents and community members can do because if it's not your child, it could be your child's friend or the child down the street. And so we all have an opportunity to save a life.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Mike Ludwig from truthout.org.
Hi, thanks for having the call. Given the racial disparities and the fact that we know that incarceration massively increases the risk of overdose, particularly for opioid users, and we're talking today about stigma, prioritizing the health of the individual for criminal punishment, I mean, would you agree with the harm reduction movement that decriminalizing small possession of all drugs is an urgent public health priority given the scale of death?
So, you know, we've really focused on working with public safety and meeting people where they are at, and that's why, you know, a lot of our programs focus on opioid use disorder are focused on incarcerated populations because we know they're at a significant risk for an overdose after returning back to public if they might not have access to this treatment. That's also why we think, you know, people who are at risk should have access to fentanyl test strips and education around it. We have a high-intensity drug trafficking program, and this is where we are working in many states with public safety because we do think it's important to reduce stigma and to have our public safety officers help people to get treatment and to decrease stigma around this.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Meryl Cornfield from The Washington Post.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my question. I'm actually hoping to squeeze in two. So firstly, I found what you had said earlier about the fact that most people who had died from overdoses, there was no evidence that they had received substance use treatment before their death, to be pretty striking. I'm wondering if you can talk more about how you found that. And then secondly, I'm wondering if you could elaborate more on what types of treatment you see as reaching people where they are culturally, especially as it relates to the communities that you've talked about.
Thanks for that question. So for our data source, we use data from the State Unintentional Drug Overdose Reporting System, or SUDRS, which is really a great sort of comprehensive surveillance to us. It allows us to capture information not only from death certificates, but also from coroner and medical examiner reports. And from that, we're able to get information like evidence of prior substance use treatment,
which was what we were able to document in this study. And you're correct. Among most people who did die of a drug overdose, very few of them actually had evidence of receiving prior substance use disorder treatment. And that, I think, could be due to maybe some limitations in the data, but I think it's also reflective of what we do see in our analysis, that for a large proportion of our decedents, many of them don't actually receive substance use disorder, and this is more pronounced among certain racial and ethnic groups. So, for example, Black people were less than half as likely as white people to actually have evidence of received prior substance use treatment. So that is a notable finding from our analysis. And I'll turn it over to Dr. Auri to answer the second part of your question.
And I was reflecting back on a patient I saw who was not in substance use treatment, but it was a missed opportunity. She had been seen a week earlier for a skin infection, likely due to injecting drugs. She returned back, unfortunately, a week later with a fatal drug overdose. And so when she was seen in the emergency department at that time, if she had been able to be linked to care, that could have potentially have saved her life, or if she'd been sent home with naloxone. So I think when we look at opportunities in the healthcare system or out in the community, so if somebody's not linked to treatment, that we can then link them to treatment, that can save a life. And in Massachusetts General Hospital, they have a really comprehensive program on this, to where they have an inpatient addiction consult team. They also have what we call low threshold bridge clinics. So when somebody's leaving the emergency department who's not yet connected to care, they're able to do that. And then integrating care with primary care settings, you know, with recovery coaches. So there's many different ways we can address this problem. And then the second question about, you know, culturally appropriate, I think there's many different ways we can do this. We have an RX awareness campaign that does focus on the dangers of opioids, and we have had specific public service announcements on this from veterans, from people from American Indian Heritage, African Americans sharing their stories so that people can see these trusted messengers. And then just for suicide prevention, I always think that the White Mountain Apache suicide prevention has been really unique. They looked at their own data. They looked at where the issues were within their tribe and were able to see reductions in death. So I think really working with communities, meeting where they're at, learning from them, and then sharing with other communities.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Julie Wernow from the Wall Street Journal.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. One of the things I found particularly disturbing in the report was that it said that there are more overdose deaths in places where there's more treatment, and that white people were almost twice as likely to receive treatment. Could you expound a little bit on what the barriers are to gaining access to this treatment, and if there are any obvious policy changes that could help with those barriers?
Yes, I think that was definitely a particularly striking finding from this analysis. And I think one, you know, as one important thing to clarify is just because there's availability of services doesn't mean that those services are actually accessible. And so some of the barriers that could be playing a role into why certain populations or certain groups might be having maybe harder time getting access to some of these treatment services include things like insurance or maybe transportation access barriers. The distribution of some of these treatment centers or places where people could get treatment for substance use disorders are not necessarily evenly distributed throughout the areas they live in. So transportation barriers are a definite factor in limiting people getting access to some of these treatment services. We also know other factors like stigmatization as well as mistrust in the general healthcare system might also prevent individuals from accessing some of these available treatment services. So there are a number of things that play a role beyond just availability of treatment services in a particular county or area that further prevents them from accessing those resources. And I can turn it over to Dr. Auri to answer the second question.
So I think when we're just looking at a lot of these access to treatment, you know, I think back to things around like telehealth. There's sometimes structural racism or discrimination to where patients could technically be eligible for telehealth, but a provider might not think, you know, about using that patient and having them available. I also just saw in clinic myself that even if the patient was eligible for telehealth, it didn't always work for them because they might not have a smartphone. They might not have a private place to do those calls. And so it's more than the policy itself. I'd say it's really around the implementation of the policy and looking at the stigma and discrimination and the circumstances that lead up to that to make sure that everybody does have equitable access to these policies. There's also things like mobile units that can meet people where they're at and help provide things like naloxone. I think expanding things like that could be helpful.
Courtney, I think we have time for two more questions.
Our next question comes from Steven Johnson from U.S. News & World Report.
Hello. Thank you for taking my question. I was wondering then, kind of following up on the last question, as to how much of an impact do you think that the federal regulations allowing for online prescribing for drugs like buprenorphine, if that's set to expire along with the COVID-19 public health emergency, how much of an impact do you think will have in terms of access?
So I think we always want to expand access to buprenorphine, and what we have seen is that even when providers did have the data waiver, they weren't at their maximum capacity. So I think the more that we can allow providers the opportunity to be aware of first how to even get the data waiver. I'm a waivered physician myself, but for those that are currently exempt from the additional training requirements, to make sure that they are doing this, that they are incorporating it as part of their primary care work. There's many opportunities for us to continue to expand this. I think for me, it's those that do have the ability to prescribe, we can continue to increase that capacity and increase the number of patients we see. And then looking at places, again, like the emergency department, when somebody comes in under the current status, they don't have to be a waivered physician. They can do an emergency bridge. And so just really making sure we're increasing opportunities like that.
Thank you.
And our last question, please.
Our last question comes from Joyce Frieden from MedPage Today.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. Wondering whether you think the new 988 hotline is going to have any effect on overdose deaths, and sort of on in a related note, whether you can tease apart if these are intentional suicide deaths versus not. And also, can you please, just for next time, identify which one of you is speaking, because that would be helpful.
Thank you. I'll start. This is Dr. Howery. So 988, I think, will be a very helpful tool. It's an easy-to-remember number. It should increase access for those that have mental health issues or need to talk to somebody to get that referral. Certainly, people that misuse substances or use substances may have mental health distress or suicidality. This will allow them that opportunity to get, you know, that voice on the other side of the line, to get those resources to prevent a suicide. So I'm very optimistic about this, and it's up and functioning and, you know, now nationally available. So certainly hope that you all include this in your stories as a way for people to get help. And I'll turn it over to my colleague to answer about the data itself.
Thank you, Dr. Howery. This is Dr. Carissa. And to clarify about the drug overdoses that were actually included in our analysis, so SUDERS captures specifically unintentional drug overdoses and drug overdoses of undetermined intent. So we would not be capturing suicides where the cause was an overdose in our analysis, neither do we capture homicides. So the analysis is restricted to just unintentional drug overdoses and drug overdoses of undetermined intent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Howery and Dr. Carissa. This will conclude our briefing. If you have further questions, please call the main media line at 404-639-3268, or you can email media@cdc.gov. Thank you.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.